On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mohandas Gandhi, the great promoter of human rights and perhaps one of the most influential men of the 20th century, brought independence to India in 1947. His teachings against colonialism, racism, and violence informed and inspired Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, and Nelson Mandela and the fight against apartheid in South Africa. That's a fight Gandhi's granddaughter, Ela Gandhi, crusaded for, embracing his philosophy of nonviolent action. It has guided her work in South Africa as both a member of parliament and an activist. This year, she is reflecting on Satyagraha, the call Gandhi made for nonviolent activism and civil disobedience 100 years ago. This hour, On Point, Gandhi's granddaughter, Ela Gandhi, and how to use Gandhi's teachings today. Joining me now in the studio is Ela Gandhi, granddaughter of Mahatma Gandhi. She is a former member of the South African Parliament, in which she served for a decade. She now runs a monthly newspaper dedicated to promoting Gandhi's principles and an organization that helps women escape abusive relationships and become self-sufficient. She crusaded against apartheid in South Africa and was placed under house arrest for almost 9 years. Ela Gandhi, it's so nice to have you here. What a wonderful treat for us to have you in our studios. Thank you.
Thank you.
From a personal perspective, I wanted to start by having you tell us what your grandfather was like.
Well, I was a little child when he passed away, about 7 years old. And I remember him as a wonderful grandfather. At that time, at the age of seven, you know, I wouldn't have much memories of his ideals and so on. But as a grandfather, he was a really great grandfather. He listened to us. He gave us time. And the stories he told us were wonderful.
Stories about...
Stories about his childhood, stories about, there were a number of stories that influenced him. And he told us about these stories.
You have such a compelling personal story. I know life was difficult for you, especially as a child. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, as a child, I grew up at Phoenix Settlement.
In South Africa.
In South Africa, a settlement which was established by Mahatma Gandhi. I wouldn't say that it was difficult at all because, yes, we had a lot of discipline. We had a rigorous childhood in that settlement because we had to follow the discipline of daily life there.
Which meant what?
Which meant that we did all the chores from the time we got up right until the evening, which meant also respecting all people, embracing all races, all religions, learning about the different religions and different race groups and so on. Looking at people as people rather than belonging to a particular class or race or, you know, the differences were sort of minimal when we interact with people.
And yet from some of the things that I have read about you, it was hard from an outsider's perspective. You were under house arrest for 9 years.
Yes, I was. It is difficult to remain under house arrest. It was particularly difficult for my children who were growing up and couldn't go out on weekends and so on. But for me, it was a price one pays for liberation. And I was passionate about our liberation. And I always compared myself to people who paid a much bigger price than I paid. In that, you know, there were so many people who were in prison, so many people who were killed in the struggle for liberation. Mm. So being under house arrest was a minimal price.
You were under house arrest simply because you were a member of the Gandhi family?
Not really, because I was involved in the struggle for liberation. There were many people in my family who were not under house arrest, but I was under house arrest because I was involved in the struggle for liberation.
I want to play a clip now of your grandfather. In 1931, Mahatma Gandhi visited London, where he shared his spiritual message with the world. Here it is.
There is an indefinable, mysterious power that pervades everything. I feel it, though I do not see it. It is this unseen power which makes itself felt and yet defies all proof, because it is so unlike all that I perceive through my senses. It transcends the senses, but it is possible to reason out the existence of God to a limited extent. Even in ordinary affairs, we know that people do not know who rules or why and how he rules. And yet they know that there is a power that certainly rules.
Ila Gandhi, how have you used your grandfather's teachings in your life?
Well, I think what he said about the power of spirituality, of God, I think played a very big role in my life, because I always felt that there was a power that guided me, that led me, and urged me to do some of the things that I have done in my life. So, yes, I was very much influenced by that. I was also very much influenced by the whole idea of nonviolence, and the Gandhian, you know, philosophy of love, and all embracing love for the universe, for people, for nature, and so on. So my life has been guided by this love.
Beyond those two things, I've actually had the pleasure of reading some of your writings where you describe the most important things, some of the other things that you've learned from your grandfather, to live a simple life. Why was that so important to him?
I think he said, you know, that the world has enough to meet the needs of everyone, but it doesn't have enough to meet the greed of everyone. So I think simplicity makes a very big difference. If each one of us lives a simple life, we can all share the bounties of this world and be happy.
I've also read where you say, have respect for all religions was something your grandfather treasured.
Yes. I think each religion, what he said is that each religion has a very important message, and that every religion is a path towards one goal. All of us believe and, you know, believe in the existence of a power, as he said. You know, some believe that there's a God, others believe that there's a power. But whatever it is, they are all parts towards a goal, a good goal that, you know, humanity strives to achieve. And therefore, it's important to respect the views of every person and every religion, and to extract the best from each religion. That is what he did in his life. He, you know, the love that Christianity talks about, agape, he, you know, imbibed that into his own life. And, you know, the Muslim idea of charity, of ensuring that, you know, your earnings, a part of your earnings go towards you know, the care of other people.
A tithe, if you will.
Yes, like a tithe, yeah. They call it by another name. I've just forgotten at this stage. But that is an important part of the Muslim religion.
May I ask you this important question, which is the relevance of Gandhi's message today? What is it? What is the relevance of his message?
Well, I think for mankind to survive the century, the message of nonviolence is the most important message. Conflict is there. Conflict is a part of life. How do you deal with conflict? Find nonviolent solutions to conflict. And that is the message that I consider to be the most important for us to survive this century.
I want to bring in now William Ury. He is the co-founder of the Program on Negotiation at Harvard Law School and director of the Global Negotiation Project. His books, Getting to Yes and Getting Past No, have sold more than 5 million copies around the world. Bill, it's nice to have you with us. Thank you.
It's my pleasure, Jane.
How have Gandhi's teachings affected your work?
Well, ever since I was in high school, actually, I wrote a paper about Gandhi and read his autobiography, and it's inspired me, and it's certainly inspired all the work that I've done the last 30 years in negotiation. And I think, really, it's just a deep honor to be here with Ela and whom I've known, had the pleasure of knowing for 5 years. And I think it's really inspired the whole field of negotiation, which really is articulating the very same principles that Gandhi expressed 100 years ago. Gandhi was a master negotiator. He was a master at showing respect to other people, putting himself in the shoes of the other, attacking the problem, not the person. All the very principles, looking for mutual gain, trying to find through dialogue. And then when it came to using power, if one had to use power, but using power in a way that didn't hurt people, but actually, as he put it, brought people to their senses, not to their knees. And those are the lessons we very much need today in all areas of our life, in our personal lives, in our work lives, and in the very important problems that face the world abroad, like in Iraq and the Middle East today.
Maybe we could talk about some of those for a moment in practical terms. Perhaps you and Ela could apply the Gandhian principles to some difficult places and situations around the world. First, quite obviously, Iraq.
Well, would you like to go, Ela?
Yeah, yeah.
One thing, what happened 100 years ago in 1906, what Gandhi realized in this meeting they had in the Empire Theater where there were 3,000 people, Hindus and Muslims, concerned about a new law that would really deprive them of all civil rights. And one person got up, was a Muslim, a Muslim merchant, actually, who had just gone on Hajj to Mecca and said, you know, with God as my witness, I will not, you know, we have to pass a resolution and all vow not to comply with this law, even if it means death. And suddenly, and Gandhi himself, he knew that he was personally capable of this, but the idea that ordinary people of all walks of life, 3,000 people would rise up and take this vow to show courage, to show discipline, to show faith, to show organization, and be willing to die but not to kill. And they were able to overturn that law, and that same very practical method, it comes from a deep place inside him, that place that he was talking about on the tape so touchingly, that invisible place. But it was very practical, and he used that tool very practically to liberate India from colonialism, hundreds of millions of people. It was used in this country to inspire the whole civil rights movement, Martin Luther King. It was used in Poland and Czechoslovakia and most recently in Serbia and Georgia. It's a very practical tool. This is not something that's just sounds soft and nice, but something that's really practical for dealing with the very real injustices and wars that face humanity today.
Is a practical tool, and yet I think there would be some people who would say that the nonviolent stance in the modern world today doesn't really work. Are we past it, Ela Gandhi?
No, I think it does work. We just don't want to give it a try. I think in the modern world, people are very anxious to get results, quick results. If you want quick results, you kill the other person and you get your quick result. But it's not true. It doesn't happen that way in reality. Because every time you commit a violence, there's more violence that comes up. And we see it in the Iraq issue. This morning they said that the situation in Iraq is worse than it was when Saddam Hussein was there. So what has changed with violence, with so much of violence? After so many people died, what has changed? And that should be an indication that violence doesn't work. The only way we can bring about real changes is through transforming people, through getting people to realize that we all share this planet together and we all have to do something about our lives in order to live together happily.
What is your take? What are your thoughts, Ila, about the ongoing conflict beyond Iraq, generally, between Western and Muslim civilizations?
I think, again, you know, the violence is largely due to the happenings of the past couple of years. I think that there is a lot of similarity, a lot of mutual understanding that can be arrived at if people are prepared to look at each other, to put ourselves in the other person's shoes. So I don't think that there is a conflict between the West and Islam. It is something that is in our minds. And if we can go beyond that and sit together and talk, we will find that there's a lot of commonalities that can be used to improve the situation.
So many of the conflicts around the world are linked to religion, as you well know, and are frequently the consequences of fundamentalism. How do you combat that?
Well, I think, you know, fundamentalism, yeah, has been a major problem. In the past centuries, during the time of the Crusades, it was a problem, and today it is a problem. We can overcome that because it's people. It's people who are being driven by preachers who preach fundamentalism. But if people begin to realize that this is not the path that we want to take, then, you know, there will be a change. So what I'm saying is we need to work at grassroots level where we can have a bigger say in people's lives than the preachers have. So it's a question of who brings the better message. Is it us, the ones who preach peace, or is it the ones who preach fundamentalism? And if we can win, that is where we can take the world to a peaceful solution.
Mm. William Ury, co-founder of the Program on Negotiation at Harvard Law School, what role does religion play in nonviolence? And is interfaith dialogue enough to make a difference between these cultures that just seem to be so at odds?
Yeah. You know, Jane, I've just come back from the Middle East, actually, where engaged in a process that involves interfaith dialogue. It's a process, an initiative we call the Abraham Path Initiative of actually creating a path, a little bit like the Appalachian Trail or the Camino de Compostela in Spain, that retraces the footsteps of Abraham, who, after all, is the kind of the unifying point for 3 billion people on the planet, and who signifies hospitality, kindness, faith, oneness. And it took us right into the heart of these issues. So we were in Turkey, we were in Syria, we were in Jordan, we were in the Palestinian territories, we were in Israel. We actually retraced the footsteps, a delegation of us, under the auspices of the Program on Negotiation. And as a kind of study tour, just to look, what's the potential for this? Because to me, at the heart of the problem are the two twin, you know, at the roots of this problem are humiliation and shame. Mm. That's what often drives fundamentalism in that reaction, and poverty and lack of voice. And so the idea of the Abraham Path Initiative is to bring the only human antidote we know to humiliation and shame, which is respect, acknowledgement, and respect toward the other, and respect towards the other's traditions, and to go back, actually, not stay away from religion, but actually to go into the religious texts, go into the religious beliefs, and evoke what is best in them, because at the core of them, they all have something very, very positive and very, you know, just Abraham reminds us that whatever divides us, what unites us is much greater. And one of the amazing things we found in all of these countries, in the midst of, you know, we're Americans, a lot of us were Americans at a time when Americans are not very popular right now in the Middle East, but coming there in this respectful way, people really gravitated to this idea, because it's not our idea, it's an idea that's there. It's we're just dusting off the footsteps of Abraham and evoking what is probably the only antidote, which is respect and tourism, bringing the economy. They want us to bring people. They want more people to come. And through that kind of interaction over a long period of time, then maybe we can actually prevent the clash of civilizations. We can actually have an alliance.
Ila Gandhi, what was your grandfather's view of the West? What was Mahatma Gandhi's view of us?
I think he didn't like the rampant consumerism often came from the West, but he had respect for a number of things that the West characterized, like organization, good organization, ability, and so on. But on the other hand, he found that the modern way of life, the individualistic tendencies in the West was not a positive sort of step. So he felt that the communal living, the family, importance of family values and living as a family, sharing, and those kinds of values were far more important.
And he saw those lacking in the Western culture.
He saw
culture.
Them lacking in the West, yeah. In the modern civilization. I think modernizing is a better word than saying West because, again, it sort of categorizes, by region. And I don't think that that's a good way of... I don't like categorization. Mm. I just want to say one thing.
You know,
in South Africa, you know, we had the Dutch Reformed Church, which at one stage during the apartheid years said that the white community are the chosen race. Today, they have changed that. And it shows that through nonviolent means, through, talking to people, people can... change their views. They can transform. And we've had some amazing results. And that was a fundamentalist, religion, which has now transformed. Mm. So, yeah.
We have a lot of callers who want to speak with you and join this conversation, Ila. I'd like to go to Jacob, who's calling from Lowell, Massachusetts. Jacob, hello, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
My original question was something that you had kind of brought up in regards to the conflicts in the Middle East, but I want to then take it a step further. We're exposed very much right now, the major conflicts we are witnessing kind of unfold on TV and the news in Iraq, the Palestinian conflict with Israel and Lebanon. What would you say to those people who are there in person and they're faced in a day-to-day life with this fanaticism, with violence, and to say to them what they can do to actually take a step back and then not respond with violence. I'm involved with some various organizations that work for human rights and peace, and I've been very dismayed because I'm encountering more and more people who, under the auspices of working for peace, will actually give credence to a violent reaction to an occupying force because they... unfortunately come to believe that that's become the only way to respond. What would you say to those people and those actually facing this violence in their daily lives? What steps can they maybe start to take to actually try to move towards a peaceful, nonviolent approaches to these conflicts?
Ila?
Yeah, I don't think that violence can, change a violent situation. Violence is not the answer to any to bring about a better solution. Whether it's in Iraq, whether it's in the Middle East, you know, Palestine or anywhere, or whether it is in your home. Think about it. If a person is being violent in the home, can you suppress that person by violence? And to me, it seems that a much better way to deal with violence is the nonviolent way. And that is, for me, the only way in which you can bring the person back into society and take up their position in society. You can't treat them with with violence. You can't change them.
Hmm. Would you like to add to that, William?
Yeah, I'd just like to say that there are many people in the region, as well as outside the region, who, like myself, believe that if, in fact, the Palestinians, for example, had adopted the strategies of nonviolent struggle that have been so successfully deployed in other parts of the world, that, in fact, they would long ago have had a Palestinian state. And it's not for us to tell people in the region, you're doing it wrong, because, you know, people we have to respect their right, you know, people under a lot of pressure. But it is a shame that these methods, in fact, these methods were used quite successfully by the Palestinians in the first Intifada, where it was the majority of occasions were nonviolent, and that, in fact, helped educate and bring enough attention to the Palestinian conditions that it initiated a peace process that almost worked in the 1990s. Mm.
I'd like to ask you, if we hear so much about people coming together in peaceful coalitions, is forming a coalition enough?
I think it's the first step. It's not enough. It's the first step towards building a force that is a nonviolent force, because we have to, you know, also have strength. And strength is important. Not violent strength, not physical strength, but in numbers. The more people we have who are standing for nonviolence, the better chances we have of really achieving nonviolent solutions.
We're speaking with Mahatma Gandhi's granddaughter, Ila, a former member of South Africa's parliament and a peace activist. Also with us is William Ury. He's co-founder of the Program on Negotiation at Harvard Law School and director of the Global Negotiation Project. I'd like to listen for a moment as we begin here to a speech that Gandhi gave in London in 1931, where he spoke about his view of God.
And is this power benevolent or malevolent? I see it as purely benevolent, for I can see that in the midst of death, life persists. In the midst of untruth, truth persists. In the midst of darkness, light persists. Hence I gather that God is life, truth, light. He is love. He is the supreme good. But he is no God who merely satisfies the intellect, if he ever does. God, to be God, must rule the heart and transform it.
Hmm. Ila Gandhi, do you remember the moment when you realized that your grandfather was Mahatma Gandhi, that he was such an extraordinary man?
Well, I grew up at Phoenix Settlement, which was established by him. And throughout life, I regarded him as a wonderful person. But it was only later in my teenage years that I began to read about his philosophies and began to realize the profound, you know, things his philosophy was for the world.
Mm. I wanted to tell you that last week, totally unrelated to this interview, I had an occasion to attend a dinner meeting at the Indian Consulate in New York City. And as I walked into this building, there was a beautiful portrait of your grandfather on the wall. I had extraordinary conversations with some business and government leaders from India, and they talked about your grandfather, about his mission to move beyond the caste system, to lift women up, to bring Hindus and Muslims together. They all praised him, but they also said that in India today, Gandhi's mindset and philosophies have been transformed into how much money can we make? How successful can we be? Pretty much like anywhere else in the world. They told me his message is more relevant than ever, but ironically, it's more irrelevant than ever. What is your response to that?
I think any message is as relevant as we want to make it. And for me, I would say, you know, as Martin Luther King had said, that we ignore Gandhi at our own peril.
How can you bring back Gandhi's transforming message, William Urey?
Well, I think what's needed in new times is new languaging. And to me, this is what I've increasingly come to see, negotiation as a language that speaks to people nowadays, because it's the language. It's a language of business. It's a language of work. It's a language that has relevance to people's personal lives. And so it's a way in which we at the Program on Negotiation over the last 20 years have been introducing the very same principles that really form the core of Gandhi's philosophy, but in language that speak to people that people can apply today. And so to me, negotiation in that is carrying on the legacy at its best, I hope. Negotiation field at its best is carrying on the legacy of Gandhi. And I think we need that. I also think we maybe need to change even the language of nonviolence, because it's a funny thing. It doesn't really appeal to people because somehow it seems soft and ineffectual, or it seems irrelevant, or it's something defined in terms of what it's not. And I think we need a new languaging. We need to harness the powers of modern communication to think about it. I think in the Philippines when they use these methods, they call it people power. And to me, that's the beginning of something. It's what we're talking about is something that's powerful, that is rooted in the mobilization of large numbers of people, that we've used in this country to get over our labor wars in terms of, you know, the rights of labor unions to get a decent justice for laborers, for working people in this country in the 20s and 30s of the last century, in the 40s and onwards. It's something that we can use now even in Iraq. I mean, right now in Iraq, we're facing the problem of how do we mobilize the world community? Because it's not going to be solved by the United States alone. It's going to be solved by the people within Iraq, by all the neighbors of Iraq, by the whole world gathering together. We need these same principles of how do you mobilize the world community to avert what is increasingly looking like a disaster.
Mm. We have so many people who want to join this conversation. Let's go to Tebaho, who's calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Tebaho, what's your question for Ila?
Hi, Ila. How are you?
Hi.
I'm good, yeah. My name is Tebaho, and I'm originally from South Africa. I've been in the USA for the past 6 years now.
Okay.
My question to you is, how do you feel about the present economic situation in South Africa, the rise in crime and the rise in AIDS? Because all those things actually come together in what's really causing a lot of violence in the townships. Actually, I have two-part questions. That's my first question. My second question to you is this. With the AWB still armed, do you think that it would be a good idea for the SBU, the self-defense units in the township, to also take arms? Because we don't want to see the same thing happen again when the country was taken by bloodshed, but, you know, we're still standing on the side passively. What's your take on that?
So the rise in violence and joblessness in South Africa and AIDS as well.
Yes. AIDS and poverty are a major issue in South Africa. And I think the minister has just released a 5-year plan to, look at the whole situation of AIDS and how we can overcome the rise in numbers of victims of AIDS. And I'm hoping that that 5-year plan is going to be successful. As far as poverty is concerned, yes, we really need to have a much better approach than the BEE approach that the government has been trying to implement for the last 10 years. But I think with the, you know, with the assistance of the community, with mobilization of communities, we will be able to overcome those issues of poverty and deprivation. Much has been achieved as well in the last 10 years. And we can talk about that at a later stage. Mm. I don't think we have enough time. But
what would you say is your proudest accomplishment during the decade that you served as a member of South Africa's parliament in using the Gandhian philosophy there?
I think, firstly, water is a commodity that, you know, every individual should have access to. And we are proud in South Africa that at least at this stage, more than 90% of the people no longer have to walk several kilometers to go and fetch water. They have running water at their doorsteps, which is a major accomplishment at this stage in South Africa.
Just within the last 10, 15, 20 years.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm. About the AWB and the SDUs in the townships, I don't think that, you know, there is at this stage real fear of the AWB. I think that, you know, really we cannot, you know, approach these issues by preaching violence. We have to begin to transform people, and that is happening. Mm. The very fact that our president and other people went to the funeral of P.W. Botha and reached out to the Afrikaner community, you know, to bridge the hostility that existed in the past between the white and the black races, is a step in the right direction. Mm.
Mm. I'd like to take a call from Hal, who's calling us from New Sharon, Iowa. Hal, you're on the air.
Howdy, ma'am. Well, I guess I want to know is how is it that in the Muslim world we can always, as Christians or Westerners, receive critique, yet at the same time, when we critique them on issues, it seems to be an issue of response and violence. And if anything at all, no matter what it is, it seems to me that we're used as a foil to distract, I think, the mass impoverished population to distract them from the fact that I think a lot of people don't realize is that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And the reality is the rich are oppressing the poor, but it's simpler for them to say that it's the United States that's the problem and not their own economic circumstances brought about by the local populations.
Ela?
Does that make sense?
You want to respond to that?
Okay, the last question, I agree that we have to have policies that are equitable, that ensure that the rich do not get richer, and that the poor also have access to funds. Like I said earlier, Gandhiji had said that the world has enough to meet the needs of everybody, but not to meet the greed of anyone. And so we have to, you know, be prepared to share. And that's the only way that we can eliminate poverty.
Are leaders a key factor in causing or avoiding conflicts? And do they have a greater role than populations do in changing the course of history?
Well, yes, leaders do. Leaders make war. And people are involved in the war. I think that if communities say that we are no longer going to make war, it can change the whole position. Look at, for instance, in the case of Milosevic, you know, there, the military itself refused to react to the population because they felt that what the people were saying was the, you know, was the right way, and refused to carry out the orders. Mm. So the military was also on the side of the people. Mm. And they refused to, you know, fire on the community.
I must ask you this question related to India. India has developed into a nuclear nation. Mm. How does that match up with Gandhi's message of peace and nonviolence?
Well, you know, a lot of people had said that Gandhism is going to come back into India from the West. Mm. I don't know if that answers the question.
What's your response to that, William?
Yeah, I would say Gandhi would be very distressed at some of the trends he sees in his native country, and or some of the trends he sees in the world at large. I remember in response to the earlier question about Western civilization, he was once asked, "Mr. Gandhi, what do you think of Western civilization?" And he answered, after thinking about it for a moment, he says, "I think it would be a very good idea." And I think that's true of all of our civilizations, actually, that this is a time right now when there's a human civilization that's just emerging. Speaking as an anthropologist, we're really in an era where for the first time in humanity's long evolution, all the tribes of the earth, all 15,000 language groups, 15,000 tribes are coming together. We're all kind of getting connected. We're being in touch with each other. It's a giant family reunion. And like family reunions, it has its problems, you know. There are inequities, there are injustices, there are resentments. And we're just in that process of working things out. And there is that hope, there is that possibility that we can learn to work out our differences, learn to respect each other, and make this truly a better world for our children. And I think that's the real message of Mahatma Gandhi.
Mm. How would you say, Ila, is the best way for those who may not fully understand Mahatma Gandhi's message, your grandfather's message, what would be your advice to them about embracing it and using it in their lives today?
I think that often, you know, we think that Mahatma Gandhi was a person who was endowed with some great, you know, spiritual powers or something. We worship him and then forget about him. I think what we really need to remember is that Mahatma Gandhi was like you and I, and he transformed his life, and it is possible for us to transform our lives.
Mm-hmm. In fact, he said, "My life is my message."
Exactly.
Do you think he was aware of his legacy?
Absolutely. In his book, he talked about all the, you know, the weaknesses that he had in his life and how he changed. He talked about, you know, his own chauvinism, for instance, and it was through experience, through talking to other people, through learning from other people and from reading, that he changed his attitude to women. And eventually he became one of the leading figures who talked about women's status and women's women's rights. So I think he was very much aware that people can transform and that you learn. And in his books, he prefaces every book of his by saying that I am still learning. Mm. I am, you know, until I grow old, I am going to be continually learning. So if I have said something many years ago and I say something different now, take the one that I have said, you know, last to be the truth and not what I said. So I reserve the right to change my mind.
What a wonderful way to end this wonderful hour. It's been an honor to meet you and to talk with you and to hear your grandfather's wonderful work. Ila Gandhi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And William Urey from the Harvard Law School, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.